99.5 North Seattle Grassroots Radio. It's just,
can you turn that up just a little tad there? Oh,
that's perfect. All right. North Seattle Grassroots Radio. My name is Johnny Bad Appleseed, and we got a whole shitload of people in the studio tonight. We got DJ, etc. And
what the hell is your name again?
Petulant Exasperation.
I can never remember that. And then we have three special guests who just came from a long trek from Washington, D.C. I don't know. Go ahead and introduce yourselves, who you're with, blah, blah, blah.
I think I came the farthest. My name's Sarah. I'm from Washington, D.C., and I worked with the Mobilization for Global Justice on the recent IMF World Bank protests.
I'm Matt. I'm actually from Seattle, although I was also in D.C. for the IMF protests. I'm with the Northwest Anarchist Federation, and I work with the Ruckus Society.
My name's Blair. I also went to Washington, D.C., and I'm also with the Northwest Anarchist Federation.
All right, we got it all squared away. Well, I don't know. It's no one handed me any questions, so we're just going to kind of do this on the fly. Maybe one of y'all want to kind of pick up and, well, why the hell did you go all the way out to D.C. anyway? That's like a hell of a hitchhiking trip.
Well, I guess kind of as people were billing it as WTO Part 2, there was over April 16th and 17th, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank were holding their yearly meetings. And kind of on the same goal, the WTO had of shutting down the meetings, a large kind of coalition mobilization of a lot of different activists and different beliefs kind of got together to try once again to shut down the meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. So we went out there as kind of one kind of support of the attempt to shut down the IMF and the World Bank, also kind of to raise kind of the public scrutiny and start raising the dialogue about what happens with globalization, what some of the problems the IMF and World Bank, and me specifically, what capitalism causes to people in third world countries and here locally as well.
Blair.
Was that?
Blair.
Blair, I'm sorry. And Blair, what brought you out to D.C.?
Well, a lot of the same reasons. The IMF is, and the World Bank are institutions that encourage, global debt borrowing in order to get this money for, you know, whatever projects. They finance a variety of projects. There's certain things called conditionalities, and which are instituted in things called structural adjustment programs. And so, well, you can have this big chunk of money, but to do it, you have to follow, you know, these strict market-based guidelines, which include devaluing currency, cutting back drastically on social services, so basically they can pay back these loans. And the end result is the mass population suffered the result of these decisions that they have no part of.
I didn't have to go that far, actually, since I was in D.C. to begin with, but I got involved in January when some friends of mine asked me to come to a meeting with them, and I was just so impressed by some of the stories that I'd heard at these meetings, at the original big organizing meetings from activists from around the world, about what the IMF and the World Bank were doing in their countries, the conditions that they were causing. And there was a deadline that seemed really far away at the time but loomed larger really fast. We just had a few months to pull off something that, compared to with the WTO in Seattle, they had a lot more time to try and do. And I started working with different groups, different working groups, on what was going to happen and doing some outreach and hoping to get as many people to show up as we possibly could. So I think that my involvement stretched out over so long that when the protests finally arrived, it was almost a little anticlimactic. It was completely unbelievable to me that these things that we'd been working on and thinking about for so long actually happened.
And I heard a little bit about your story and what happened. Why don't you let everyone out there who's listening know?
I did organizing for this for 4 months and didn't actually go to the protests because I was arrested the week before. And I was with a group of six other organizers who were taking supplies from one location to another, and we were stopped by the D.C. police and some other agency with unidentified officers who we'd been under surveillance apparently for some time, and they stopped us and charged us with possession of implements of a crime and conspiracy to possess implements of a crime, and we were taken to jail. And those charges are still pending. We're going to trial over this, but the things that we had were PVC piping, chicken wire, duct tape, some small hand tools, personal property, and the conditions of the arrest were very unconstitutional and very suspicious, and this is something that we're still working on with the legal team, but it was a little interesting. I was prepared to be arrested, but not necessarily beforehand in quite that way. And we were given a stay-away order, so I wasn't able to actually go down during the 16th and 17th. But I did legal support for the affinity groups that I was working with, and that worked out okay.
So how has your opinion changed, or has it changed on our democratic society since then?
My travel to the prison culture was quite the eye-opening experience, and it really made me think a lot about the conditions under which the police operate and the government and how they work in conjunction with each other and their accountability in terms of they can do pretty much whatever they want and look at the consequences later on, but that may mean that you spend a week in jail, or it may mean that you don't have, you have your rights violated during that time, and it's a very uncomfortable position to find yourself in. Luckily, I knew that we had support the whole time that we were in jail, and that we were going to have legal assistance, and the other people that we were being held with, some of them hadn't, you know, had no one who had any idea that they were in jail and that they were being held, and it really, I would never like to find myself in that situation again without being prepared for it, and I felt a lot of empathy for the people that experience that every day now.
Matt or Blair, do you, either one of you, want to explain your experience? Did you have any experiences that were really sort of outrageous, or?
Well, for me, it was a lot different from the WTO organizing and protests that happened here. It was, you know, we'd been involved with that for a long time, organizing and whatnot, and we were hooked in with the affinity group. As opposed to, we're in D.C., we kind of were Johnny come lately. We just showed up and were, you know, kind of last minute additions, trying to just figure out where we could plug in. So we had more of a, I don't know, observing role and fly by the cuff type of thing. But I don't know, there was a lot of inspiring things that happened. For me, one of the best things was just the movement building that went on. Lots of different communication between groups that was largely absent here in Seattle, such as like the Black Bloc. There was a lot more radical voice. There was, I think I heard an estimate of like 1,300 people on the revolutionary anti-capitalist Black Bloc, where in Seattle, at a lot of blockades and actions, the Black Bloc was kind of turned away or yelled at or whatever. Places we showed up, or they showed up in D.C., there was chalk on the ground that said, "Welcome, Black Blockers," and everybody agreed on the positive role that they had. Matt, would you have some insights?
I definitely agree that the revolutionary and the capitalist bloc was one of the most inspiring things. In Seattle, there wasn't a whole lot of dialogue about it. A lot of people seemed like they wanted to be in a more radical critique of what the WTO was about, as well as their tactics, what was going to be a little more radical, but there wasn't much dialogue and forethought about it, and it seemed like a lot of just kind of haphazard actions of window breaking or graffiti and vandalism. In D.C., there had been an ongoing dialogue about it for months prior, and the Black Bloc was highly organized. It didn't have any sort of central leadership or decision-making, but people in general were kind of organic and had a kind of a single conscience, in a sense, that they really had thought about it. And
when you say ongoing dialogue between who?
Well, dialogue, I think one of the biggest things to come away from the activist movement, from WTO, was a lot of discussion about tactics, what's appropriate when, in terms of doing property destruction versus not doing property destruction, and the issues of what brought on the police brutality a lot of people attributed to the Black Bloc. So there was a lot of debate between that and a lot of divisiveness between different movements and different groups about what was appropriate when and what wasn't. In D.C., people took that into account on both sides, and there's a lot of discussion both within generally the anarchist circles about what tactics were appropriate, as well as with other more progressive or mainstream groups about what tactics people were planning on using and how to respect each other's different tactics and different ideologies. And in D.C., it was really phenomenal because the Black Bloc was much more organized. It was a singular march, essentially. And while there was property destruction, it seemed like it had a more forethought. People really thought about what they're doing and the effectiveness of each action. Rather than just breaking your window, for instance, they do things like taking construction fencing and using it as a blockade, using benches and breaking things to use as blockades, or just do something that would actually be effective in slowing police down and causing something other than just simple property destruction that they could easily be marginalized by. And just a really good respect for both each other's different tactics. Like, as Blair said, we'd come to a blockade, people would be supporting us, and we'd come to a blockade for the purpose of supporting them. If their police were trying to break through or something, we'd come in and reinforce, and it was just really inspiring to see that respect for different tactics and ideologies.
So do you think that D.C., the experience in D.C. was sort of a progression from what happened in Seattle, or do you just think it's like it was a different scenario, and what do you see happening in the future? I mean, is this like just a beginning?
I'd say it was a definite progression. I think in terms of sheer numbers, there was less people, but in terms of the numbers of people who were willing to do direct action, who were there for much more committed and much more articulate reasons, it was really phenomenal. The movement's definitely building. And definitely, I mean, while people see it, some people see it as a letdown because the meetings themselves weren't able to be shut down. I think it was definitely really effective in terms of building the movement, which is what I see as being much more important than a symbolic thing of shutting down a meeting.
I think that I wasn't in Seattle. I was at home during that time, but I think that I felt that a lot of people, myself included, saw a definite progression in terms of some of the issues that the different groups that were making up the coalition dealt with in terms of trying to do outreach to the local community and get more people of color and minorities involved, in terms of the discussion on tactics, in terms of dealing with a heightened awareness by the police of what was going to happen and trying to prepare for that. And there really was a major effort being made to try to discuss in some way the issues that had risen from Seattle that we were concerned about, people and, you know, the critics in the media saying, well, this happened again, and why didn't they talk about it? And I think that I still did hear a little bit of that, but one topic that comes to mind is the involvement of the local community of people of color. And in D.C. there was extensive local outreach being done, and during the week leading up to the protests there were mobilization supported several actions. There are a lot of evictions going on in Washington right now regarding some low-income housing and slumlords, that people are now being evicted to build higher-income housing. And the mobilization reached out to support those movements. Well, the people were in D.C. for that, and we could lend a lot of support, so I thought that was really great. But when the media questions and says, well, there's still just really weren't a lot of people of color out there. These are middle-class, privileged, white college students who are just out here wasting taxpayers' money and wasting their own time. I would say that, especially in D.C., where it is a majority of minority or African-Americans in the city itself, they're used to seeing police brutality and police repression every day. And I can completely understand why they might think that going out and subjecting yourself to that voluntarily is preposterous. That does not sound like any fun. And yes, we are privileged in the sense that we have the support and we have the time and we have the knowledge to go about it and feel comfortable doing it, whereas they have had experiences that lend them to believe that it was not going to be a smart thing to do. So I think that was one issue that didn't really come up. And it will take time to build inroads with other community associations. There was a lot of work done with religious groups of different faiths, especially in the African-American community, because we felt that would be a good way to reach more people. And I think that I felt personally that I did see a lot more people of color, even in the coverage that was shown, and people who were there agreed with me that it wasn't overwhelming numbers by any means, but it was a definite progression.
Just wondering, have you heard any accounts, or maybe you have a personal account of what happened with the micro radio station that was set up in the city to do reports on the scenes and all that? My understanding is there were some incidents that happened around that.
I have a vague notion of what happened. I know several people that were really involved with that. It was. As always, with such a big event, there were so many things going on that it was really hard to keep track of everything that happened. And I didn't hear about this until a good bit later, but they had set up a micro radio broadcasting station, and I believe it broadcast successfully through Sunday, and I think this might have happened Monday, but I could be totally off on the dates, that the police showed up. They figured out where it was, they showed up, and they were trying to shut it down. And a group of maybe 200 to 300 people happened to be coming to the radio station or was on the way somewhere else that was part of the mobilization, and they effectively kept the police from shutting it down. The police saw this mass of people willing to stand up for the radio station, and the police left. And so that was quite a success, and it was a little surprising to me that it worked out that way. I was really excited about that.
When I was on the streets during the WTO, and as I told you all earlier, I didn't really, you know, except for things here and there about the IMF, I didn't really hear that much about what happened in D.C. It seemed like everything was like either downplayed or, I'm wondering, in just like a big general sense of like your personal experiences, what you all saw. I mean, there's all sorts of specifics, but I mean, that's sort of a really big thing to say there.
Well, the morning of the big day struck me a lot. Similar to WTO protests, we headed down really early at the crack of dawn, and we weren't actively participating in a blockade, or at least beforehand we weren't. We knew we were just going to join in haphazardly as, you know, opportunities arose. But we went to a particular blockade. It started off, and people, you know, set up their lock boxes or whatever and sat down, took over an intersection. The cops came in really quick, responded much quicker than like at Seattle they did, surrounded the protesters. Another circle of protesters surrounded them, and then people started, the cops started kind of revving up their engines and starting to nudge people out of the way with their motorcycles. And it looked like things were getting ready to fall apart. People were starting to back down. And one individual kind of threw themselves basically underneath this motorcycle. And then a bunch of other people lied down right in front of the motorcycles. There's this big macho display where the cops would back up their motorcycles in front of a line of people, rev their engines, floor it towards these people, and stop within inches of running them over. And it's just, they kept doing this back and forth. And it was just pretty silly. But finally they backed down, and we eventually moved to let them out of the area. And then there was just impromptu flying blockades going up all over, like every block away from this central location. You know, every block you went to, there was a blockade there. Later in the day, I hooked up with the Revolutionary Anti-Capitalist Black Bloc and followed them around. And like me and Matt had talked about a little bit about them, that they were just really inspiring. They're a lot more organized this time around. There was a lot more. At one point, it was really inspiring for me. It was we got in this long straightaway, all 1,300 of us. We were approaching this hospital, apparently, that, you know, being anarchists, the cops thought they were going to go in and take the old people off life support or something. And so they flew in out of nowhere and set up this little line, at which point the Black Bloc, without a second's hesitation or like a word or a thought, just started screaming and running straight at them full bore. It was like a scene out of Braveheart. It was really incredible. And when they reached the line, they just kind of banked right really quickly, and the cops must have just peed their pants. It was really an awesome moment. And later on, this like bolstered them, like that we'd had this strength. And this one, you've probably seen the footage of taking the fence down and pushing the cops back. And at a blockade that the cops had attacked later in the day, after this initial attack, which kind of failed, the people stood their ground, pushed them back, and continued to push them back for about five blocks, which was pretty unprecedented. As far as I'm concerned, it didn't happen in Seattle. Like, we were not offensively, we were being completely defensive, but just holding our space and like reclaiming space, and the cops pretty much took off.
So was there a lot of tear gas and rubber bullets?
No. Comparatively, very little. I actually don't know anything about any rubber bullets being fired. I think there was really marginal use of tear gas at a few places. A lot of more direct pepper spray of like individuals and whatnot. And I was in Seattle. I was locked down most of the day, so I didn't get around a lot. I mean, I saw footage afterwards and whatnot. But to me, I saw a lot more just like actual physical violence, just cops with batons like knocking the hell out of people. You know, just, but it's more individual, less like random, like shooting pepper spray or shooting tear gas out into these big crowds and whatnot.
I just know from what I've heard that there was supposedly some tear gas used, but not by anywhere near the magnitude as in Seattle. And there was a lot of smoke bombs that people thought initially were tear gas. The police would throw out, you know, smoke bombs, makes, you know, some dust, some noise, but it wasn't tear gas. There were, I believe, some instances of rubber bullets being used, but very few, but a lot of just straight up cops running people over with motorcycles and horses and in some cases cars, and beating people with batons and things like that, shoving and pushing, and it was very, very well handled by the media. It was very set up for good PR opportunities for Police Chief Ramsey. The local news media ate that up lovely, but the national news media actually, we thought, did a fairly decent job of covering what was really going on and not just taking the police line and setting that out as the official word. And I was at home the whole time, and I started watching the local news at 6:30 in the morning, and I was incredibly depressed by what I saw. But when people started filtering back into my house later on in the day, I was hearing stories, and I just couldn't believe that they'd taken place, because from watching the news, you never would have known. So it was pretty awesome.
That actually seems pretty typical, because that's exactly the way it was here in Seattle. I mean, you watch the television, and what you'd see on the streets would be completely, you know, mm-hmm. two different things, picking and choosing.
I felt that was definitely the case, and I, in one instance, that a friend of mine spoke with a television reporter who he'd just overheard saying that, oh, all the delegates are inside and the meetings have started as scheduled, and this person knew that they'd just turned away a bus with some delegates on it. He told her that, and she said, well, that's what they told me to say. So the media was very unreliable in that sense, and I think that the independent media that was there did a great job of helping to get the word out, especially over the internet and with the micro broadcasting radio and things like that, was definitely beneficial in augmenting what people knew about sooner. Because these just stories do eventually come out, but sometimes it takes a lot longer when you have to fight the Washington Post for the cover story, which is not necessarily going to be very balanced.
One question I have is, I know that, like, during the WTO, there's a lot of work, you know, a lot of stories, a lot of people I talked to that were, you know, visibly saw, like, abuses in the prisons. And I've heard some things about D.C., and this maybe has less to do with what we're talking about, but just in a general term, I'm really kind of sad that nothing has happened with the abuses that went on in the jails here in Seattle. And I know that I've heard some things about D.C. In fact, I heard a whole bunch of shit about what went on in D.C.'s. Maybe any of you all personally, I mean, I know that you were only in for, what, 24 hours, but people you know, I mean, what stories did you hear about that? What do you...
Well, there a lot of the craziness that happened surrounded the actual incident of arrest. On Saturday, as many people know, there was a separate demonstration regarding the prison industrial complex, and there was basically a block that was closed off with people in it who were just mass arrested, a lot of bystanders, a lot of press, things like that, and that was not very good for the police department in terms of their media spin. But those people, some of them were held through the protests for several days because they weren't giving their names, they were practicing jail solidarity. Same thing with people who were arrested on Monday, and some of them were in jail for almost a week, I believe 5 to 6 days. And the stories of what happened when they were being held both by the D.C. police and by the U.S. Marshals, which is they have jurisdiction when you're actually in the holding cells in the courtroom, was absolutely incredible. I've heard stories that that are appalling, that people have had to experience this. These are nonviolent protesters, and, you know, regardless of what they may be accused of, they're still innocent until proven guilty, and you have the cases of prison guards or police smashing people's heads into the floor, keeping people handcuffed with wet clothes on for days on end, without food and water, without necessarily phone calls. And these are conditions that, when there's so many other things going on following the protests, that the news doesn't necessarily pick up on. But there are several legal suits pending. The ACLU and the legal group that works with the Mobilization for Global Justice are working on building several civil suits regarding the harassment by police and the police brutality and some of the prison conditions that happened afterwards. So hopefully I think some good will come of that. There'll be continued attention on what happened to people while they were in jail, because the media, the majority of the press that we got, was focused on the actual protests and not what happened to people who were out there trying to get a message out about some global institutions and then had some very personal repercussions fall on them.
what do you think is going to happen from here? I mean, do you see other... I mean, the way I see it, it's sort of a transnational. Like, a lot of the protesters, most of the protesters going there are not necessarily even local. And, I mean, do you guys see this just continuing more and more and more in the future?
Definitely. I think that the networking that's been going on and the coalition building will continue. There's a lot of events coming up that there's already a lot of information getting out about the police trying to prepare for, because they're afraid that this kind of event is going to show up again, which tells you a lot about the threat that they think that we pose, which I think is a compliment, honestly. But in Philadelphia and in Los Angeles for the presidential conventions, the Democratic convention and the Republican convention, and there's the upcoming IMF meetings in Prague, which is not even in the country but out of the country, and a lot of people are talking about trying to either do solidarity demonstrations for here or actually going to Prague to work with that. And I think, I hope, one of the lasting things that's going to come out of it is people maintaining the connections and working together to show that people are concerned beyond their single issues about the overarching conditions that we live in and the institutions that are creating them without our knowledge and without our input, and that you can now mobilize large amounts of people to show up, which eventually can help alter public opinion to show people what's really going on.
Yeah, I just want to say I definitely think that was, like, people spoke of, like, the failure of D.C. and, like, the media really liked to harp on that as if the cops weren't going to be completely ready. You know, Seattle WTO was a fluke. I mean, they hadn't seen anything like that in this country for a very long time, so they were really ready during the IMF World Bank protests. But what was really inspirational was the movement building, was seeing people going beyond their single issues, starting to develop a more radical critique, seeing it's not just things like the World Bank and the IMF, but getting at the underlying, like, logic of capitalism and some of the more root causes at issue here, and just seeing people, I don't know, really branch out and network, like Sarah had said. And these networks are continuing to go on through, like, Prague and these other actions, and, you know, it's just the beginning. And to expect these single day of action protests to, like, go, you know, be the things that are going to be the nail in the coffin, that's not where it's going to be. It's going to be this networking that was just beginning.
I think on another level, too, I know in D.C., from what I've seen personally in the last 2 weeks, there's been an amazing amount of commitment to maintaining the local connections that were made between different groups and the local activist networking and working with the community. And I think it inspired a lot of people by showing them how these issues related to their daily lives and to similar policies that are enacted by the federal government in regards to D.C. locally, which doesn't have statehood. We're a little colony that they can do whatever they want with. But it's been really great to see that people are saying, well, you know, this was really motivational and really inspiring, and we were so glad that everyone came out here, but we're still here, and we still want to work with these groups, be it under the umbrella of the Mobilization for Global Justice or other organizations.
Kind of a little shift of focus here, I guess. One of the things that I kept seeing over and over again, both in the local press and the Washington Post and the New York Times and all the rest of the boss rags, is that it was all about protest. The media claimed that there wasn't any articulation in terms of what sorts of institutions that would replace things like the World Bank and capitalism and that kind of thing. Can you kind of go into what sorts of things you'd like to see that would replace institutions that, you know, like the World Bank and so forth?
I think a lot of what the media was saying in D.C. was that these are a lot of kids who are just out there to protest for protest's sake. There isn't an articulate message of what they want, why they're here, what they want changed. And I think that's an easy way that they're going to use to marginalize this. I think the beauty was the fact that there wasn't a single articulate message, that a lot of different people were there for a lot of different reasons and a lot of different beliefs. And while in a future sense, it'd be nice to see kind of an overlying ideology or belief among a whole lot of people about what they want to see change when, I think it's really amazing the fact that shows the movement building. There's so many different thoughts out there and so many different backgrounds for people. In terms of things being changed, I mean, there's people come from a lot of different viewpoints. There's a lot of people who are opposed to capitalism on a fundamental level and don't believe that, like, you know, in a utopian world, there wouldn't be a need for IMF or World Bank or WTO. There's lots of people who, like the AFL-CIO, for instance, who just simply just want to have their seat at the table with these kind of institutions. So, I mean, it really depends on what your perspective is. I think for a lot of people out there, they are developing, as Blair said, a more radical critique of the social problems and what the institutions like the IMF and the World Bank represent and what they're going to reinforce, regardless of how they're structured, who sits on their board, who makes their decisions. And I think for a lot of people, they don't need to be institutions that replace these. I mean, not necessarily in the long term. In the short term, there are things like simply having them have more accountability. But a lot of people believe these institutions are just simply flawed. And there's no point in restructuring them, for instance, or even necessarily having something replace them. I don't think there needs to be an overlying body that represents free trade for corporations. I don't think there's a point in replacing the WTO.
Also, I mean, along those lines, it's not for us as a group of people, a relatively small group of people in proportion to the amount of people in the world who are concerned with the effects of these organizations, to say, well, this is what we ought to have instead. And it's great to put forth a lot of different ideas. And by doing things like this, where we manage to educate many, many people about what really goes on in other countries, especially under these institutions, under the World Bank and the IMF, we can then bring in other people who have new ideas and eventually reach some sort of consensus, hopefully, on whether or not they need to be reformed or abolished or replaced with something similar or very different. And that this, it was very important to go out there and actually attempt to physically stop the meetings from happening, but it was also really important to educate as many people as possible through the outreach that happened before and through the outreach that happened through the media and that's happening still, in terms of, hey, come on out here and tell us what you think about these and what do you think we should have, you know, happen afterwards, because it affects way more people than the people who actually just made it to D.C.
So yeah, the protests, the big individual days or weeks. What about, I know that you all are involved with things on a day-to-day level. If people feel, say, frustrated or not happy with the state of the world, but they're not going to wait for, like, the next big protest, what sort of activities or, what can people do daily?
Especially for WTO and for people living in Seattle, there's a ton of stuff. Activism has really been rejuvenated, and there's a ton of different projects going on. Specifically, me and Blair have just kind of started a new project called the Northwest Anarchist Federation, which is kind of, we're basically trying to be a really broad umbrella group for a lot of different beliefs coming from an anarchist, non-hierarchical, mutual aid cooperative perspective. That is something that's not focused on a single issue or a single action or a single, you know, single really anything, kind of being an ongoing group that works to organize different people, different existing groups, on principles of anarchism, like mutual aid and cooperation, for instance. So a lot of projects we're working on is basically trying to find ways that make these things more relevant to the average person's daily life, showing how existing cooperatives work in terms of bookstores, like Left Bank Books, micro radio stations, which usually work on collective principles, as well as getting a lot of literature out there to people that's written from a non-academic perspective that's more, is essentially just making it relevant to their lives and show how people can get more involved in taking control of their own lives and their own destiny.
If you want to do something on a day-to-day level, go out and find some information that you've never read before, read it, think about it critically, don't just accept what anybody says about things, look into it yourself, and tell two people what you found out. And that's one of the most important things. A year ago, 2 years ago, I wouldn't have ever pictured myself being here, having been in Washington, doing the things I was doing, and it was because other people took the time to let me know what was going on and explain it to me in a way that was relevant to me that I got involved. And until a lot more people are involved, it's very difficult to make large changes or to be able to demand the kind of changes that we're asking for. And doing outreach on a personal level is really, really important. And that you can do that on any issue that you're concerned with, be it the IMF and the World Bank or a local issue regarding literacy or absolutely anything.
Blair, do you? I'm sorry, I'm putting you on the spot.
That's okay. I would just echo those same things that, a huge first step is just becoming educated about what it is. And I think more and more people are going to become educated because it's going to start to directly affect their lives. People like the steel workers down in Spokane or down in Tacoma that have been locked out, these connections between exporting jobs or, you know, exploiting markets and industries and labor pools in other countries, and American workers are going to start to lose out because of our privileges. You know, if multinational corporations can get the same product or the same resources or the same labor another place, well, for cheaper, they're going to do that. And when it starts to hit home, that's when it's going to radicalize. You know, there was steelworker people out there arm in arm with Earth First. There was an anarchist, you know, because they'd start to feel, they felt these losses. And I don't know, I think more and more those are gonna start to happen because the struggle is becoming transnational. It's gonna cross these class lines as well.
Excellent. I agree. In fact, it's what we're gonna do. What we're gonna be doing is we're gonna be bringing, turning it all into mud except for the high rises. Do you all want to take a break for a little bit and play a little bit of music maybe, and you can sing and dance? And
I have one more question before we take a break, and I actually have to go, but it was great talking to you guys. How do you feel about SUVs?
I'll admit I did drive a truck, which is recently broken down. It's honestly been like the most inspiring things the past couple months for me, to be forced to not have a vehicle and be riding my bike using mass transit. I used to always kind of procrastinate, be like, it's okay, you know, I'll just drive here, I'll just drive there. I've totally cut down on my consumption in general, as well as my driving habits. In terms of SUVs, I don't know. Blair drives one. You should talk to him.
Yes, it's true. We came here in one tonight. It's a long story, one I didn't have a lot of choice in, but it's actually being sold right now to finance me going to school. So.
An anarchist school. I don't own a car. I've won't own a car. I think SUVs are awful and scary, and I've gotten hit by cars before, and I think an SUV probably would have killed me if that would have been the situation. So I think they're wasteful and expensive and pretentious and awful. They roll over and kill little children. And I can't think of a single good thing to say about them. They don't even name them creatively anymore. So.
What about the people driving them?
People driving them?
Fuck Tim Iman.
If they'd get off their cell phone, if they'd get off their cell phones, I'd talk to them and see what they thought about it. But it seems to be a problem.
Okay, bye, guys.
Bye. She's leaving. We're not.
Well, on that note, I think that we here at NSGR should play a commercial, because we're a non-commercial station. So how about queuing up CD2, Mr. Engineer?
Yeah, I got it ready.
CD2?
CD2?
I got some in CD1.
I know.
You want CD2.
It's a commercial.
It'll work.
All right. 99.5 North Seattle Grassroots Radio, and now a word from our sponsor.